Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, folks. And as we kind of pull and move forward, we're going through content, and so what we want to do is quickly get into the five critical documents, because I know that's going to take us probably a week or two. And so we just want to make sure we kind of get through the obligatories. Don't forget to send Jerry Wistrand some love by contributing to his campaign. He's running for state auditor of Missouri. We're going to be interviewing him. And so I don't know if we'll air his interview on Friday, Monday, whatever. But we'll have a couple of back-to-backs. We'll probably interview him for two, three, whatever it takes. Because you need to understand the problem that the party creates, especially in these states where the party is going unchecked. And so when you actually have real resistance in the state, or when you finally get the party of your state to take a stand on the Constitution, then you're heading in the right direction as a state, as a party apparatus. But the only place, if you want to just walk into a state and be a part of a party that is fully supporting the Constitution, you need to move to Montana. Not Montana, it's just Wyoming. Why, boy, I must have dyslexia today, or I should say Tourette syndrome. Maybe that's what it is. Welcome back, Sean. So,
good to be here, sir.
My mind is going in all these different directions, and so whatever's fleeting in my mind ends up becoming the thing that comes out of my mouth. So let me get back to this concept of the party actually being in support of the Constitution. Montana's not there. As a matter of fact, Montana has serious problems. I actually just want you to know that it looks like South Dakota folks might actually be head and shoulders with Wyoming. There are very few states where we actually have a true commitment to demanding full compliance of the Constitution, where people want to start learning their, I love this word, yearning for actually the truth and the knowledge necessary so that they can take the proper position and head the proper direction in restoring their Republican form of government. So few people even recognize you do not have a Republican form of government anymore. The judiciary has stolen it from you. And they've been working along with the parties, the corporations and banks, and the executive, and everybody else that wants to control you, other than you yourself. See, in a Republican form of government, my friends, that means we are in control with our government, not the government in control with the judiciary, specifically the where they've assumed powers they're not supposed to have. If you start understanding this, I can understand, Sean, that when I talk about the nuances of this judiciary form of government and so forth, it may confuse people. When it comes down to understanding who rules you, now that's basically those bodies or those agencies that you have to get through, or they basically control every aspect of your life, or they share those controls with others. And what we have here is this hybrid sharing between the court system, the bureaucracies of the executive, the corporations and banks and their laws and how they want to regulate you so that they can get every disposable dime out of you, whether that be the tire industry, whomever, because we hear me complain about that all the time. But the bottom line is this. You are being tapped. Your property is being taken from you. Your rights, which are your property, are being taken from you as well. And the only way we're going to get these things back is if we assume the control over our Republican form of government. We have to re-enable our representatives to start fixing everything. So anyway, we are diving into the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, out the gate, the Whiskey Rebellion was a response to the whiskey tax. And the whiskey tax came out in 1794. The Whiskey Rebellion actually happened in 1790, 1792. And as a matter of fact, we kind of have this history that I kind of want to go through that I've got Sean. And I've gone through this before, but I'll have Sean read through this. But when we look at the actual tax itself, I believe it was after the Assumption Act of 1790, where Alexander Hamilton started getting ambitious and creative in trying to create excise taxes so that he could bring revenue into the federal government to help aggressively pay off taxes, or I should say pay off our debt by bringing taxes in. And so excise taxes were one of those things that they actually passed, and they started going after. And one of the taxes that Hamilton proposed was a tax on horse transactions, the selling of horses. That was viewed as non-uniform because very few states in the North had horses, and they didn't have hardly any horse transactions, where in the South, you know, horses were integral to the work necessary in the plantations and so forth, where horse transactions were common in the South. And it was viewed what Hamilton was doing was he was levying a tax against the South that would affect them adversely, where it wouldn't have any effect on the North. Remember, the preamble to Article 1, Section 8 says that all taxes must be uniform. Therefore, the horse excise tax, or the sales, or transaction sales tax, that they wanted to place upon horse transactions was viewed as non-uniform, that the burden would really be placed upon the southern or the agrarian states where they had these large plantations and so forth. So he got, you know, into these other thoughts and so forth, and then the whiskey or the distilled liquor tax became the next obvious one, because at this point in time in the 1790s, basically in the 18th and 19th century, because of a lack of refrigeration, distilled liquor was very common as a staple. When I see that, I mean, we're not talking about hardcore distilled, amped up alcohol. We're talking about basically distilling, you know, a grain juice where it was still, you could still kind of taste the grain that you were drinking, because the proof of the alcohol was probably 20, 40 proof. Something like that. It wasn't 80 proof. It wasn't above 50 proof. So anyway, so Sean, I'm sure you got the document there, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we'll dive into this and just let me lay this out now. So the tax basically got laid out and sent out. We as a nation have a response, or we have a civil process of responding. If the government, you know, gives us something that we're not to be happy with, what are we supposed to do? If we don't like what government is doing, what do we do, Sean?
We petition them for redress.
There you go. See, even back then, they kind of knew, but now that we were governing ourselves and we didn't have the king, and because the Magna Carta seemed to be this, you know, distant thing, we had this Constitution, and technically, what year was the Bill of Rights ratified?
Was it 1897?
So, no, the Bill of Rights ratified. The
1787.
Well, 1787 was when the Constitution was written. The Constitution was ratified in 1788. The federal government was formed in 1789, and the Bill of Rights were created and sent out to the states in 1789 for ratification. It took 2 years, so it was 1791 when the Bill of Rights, or I should say the 10 amendments, not the whole Bill of Rights, but the 10 amendments that were ratified, became affixed to the Constitution. And in so doing, in 1791, we now had this, you know, these protections, and the right was galvanized. It wasn't that the federal government didn't have and established the right of petition. It basically created a protection to ensure that no government, the federal government and later on no government, would create any law that would abridge your right to petition government for the redress of grievances. In other words, government is out here. They're proud. They're proud to serve you, and they will be held accountable to redress your grievances. That was the concept. That was the design. We were to be civil. We weren't to go out and just say, hey, you know, they're doing these things, and then start shoot, pow, 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 you know, and just, you know, creating a ruckus and creating chaos and fear. That was deemed uncivil behavior. It was even brought up in the ratification debates that we can't allow those types of things. We have to maintain law and order. We are now a civil society under a new governing document called the Constitution. So go ahead and kind of read through this. And if you hit a part where you say, you know what does this mean? Or you want to amplify something, by all means, use your discretion. Because this is kind of some text that I pulled together, kind of cleaned up a little bit. But let's go ahead and go into this Whiskey Rebellion document we've got. Go ahead.
The Whiskey Rebellion was a 1794 uprising of farmers and distillers in western Pennsylvania in protest of a whiskey tax enacted by the federal government. Following years of aggression with tax collectors, the region finally exploded into a confrontation that resulted in President Washington sending in troops to quell what some feared could become a full-blown revolution. Opposition to the whiskey tax and the rebellion itself built support for the Republicans, who overtook the Federalist Party for power in 1802. The Whiskey Rebellion is considered one of the first major tests of the authority of the newly formed U.S. government.
Okay, so a couple of corrections I would throw into this is that the Whiskey Rebellion really began in 1792. When the first protests really started going into this. And I think we're actually going to cover a little bit of the tax itself. We might even name some names that's just down the way. This is just a general picture. So keep going. Just go ahead and keep reading through these paragraphs. If you want to pause, that's fine. We can talk a little bit about something. But let's just go through this dialogue. Just go ahead. You're telling the story here. Go ahead.
As stated, individual states incurred significant debt from the Revolutionary War. In 1790, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton pushed for the federal government to take over that debt. He also suggested an excise tax on whiskey to prevent further financial difficulty. President George Washington was opposed to Hamilton's suggestion of a whiskey tax, and in 1791, Washington journeyed through Virginia and Pennsylvania to speak with citizens about their views. Local government officials met the idea of a whiskey tax with enthusiasm, and Washington took his assurance back to Congress, which passed the bill. But protests against the new tax began immediately, arguing that the tax was unfair to small producers. Under the new law, large producers paid the tax annually at a rate of 6 cents per gallon, and the more they produced, the further the tax breaks. However, small producers were stuck with paying 9 cents per gallon in taxes. Farmers took further issue because only cash would be accepted for tax payment.
Okay, so what you've kind of mentioned is it seemed like the way the tax was being applied, they already baked into a non-uniform taxation. Because remember, taxes were supposed to be uniform. And if certain taxpayers had an advantage because of the volume, then that right there violated the spirit of the uniformity clause. Now, you got to remember that Hamilton had no reverence towards the Constitution and actually was more in favor of giving advantage to those who already had advantages. Because by creating alliances with those who had more power, he was basically wielding more power himself. So as this kind of went out, this went out in this, I'll just say, an unconstitutional form that Hamilton was getting away with. So let's dive into this whole thing. And one of the things you're going to notice that might actually be significant, and we look at the date today. Keep going.
The whiskey tax. The law was immediately a failure, since refusals to pay the taxes were as common as intimidation against officials hired to collect them. Excise officers sent to collect the tax were met with defiance and threats of violence. Violence first broke out on September 11, 1791. Excise officer Robert Johnson was riding through his collection route in western Pennsylvania when he was surrounded by 11 men dressed as women. The mob stripped him naked and then tarred and feathered him before stealing his horse and abandoning him in the forest.
Now, I just want everybody to know that the transgender movement was not alive and well back then. These men were hiding their disguise as, you know, they're trying to disguise themselves so they couldn't be readily identified, because this gentleman, did they identify? Yeah, Robert Johnson, you know, he was from that area. So he would have, and I think he actually recognized one or two of the women in the group. Okay, so go ahead. Yeah, there it is right there in the next, just the next paragraph. Keep going.
Johnson recognized two men in the mob. He made a complaint and warrants were issued for their arrest. A cattle drover named John Connor was sent with warrants, and he suffered the same fate as Johnson. He was tied to a tree in the woods for 5 hours before being found. In response, Johnson resigned his post, fearing further violence. Incidents escalated over the next few years, and in 1793, the home of Pennsylvania excise officer Benjamin Wells was broken into twice. The first time, a mob of people forced their way in and assaulted Wells' wife and children. The second incident involved six men in disguises who attacked Wells while he was at home. The intruders demanded Wells' account books at gunpoint and insisted he resign his position.
Okay.
What amazes me is that, think about how this wasn't far removed from the revolution they just had when they fought the British over taxes. And then now they're trying to tax them again unfairly. Yeah, I would imagine that would be a very serious situation.
Well, okay, so let's place context to this. In 1793, so we at the beginning of the year, were hit as a nation with taxes. The framers, or I should say our forefathers, they didn't form the Sons of Liberty and started throwing tea into the drink. That actually came later when frustration started to rise. The first thing they did was they organized themselves and they petitioned the king. And they continued to petition the king until they got frustrated to a point where they started organizing more at the state level and then across state boundaries and ultimately creating Continental Congress. In other words, things kept on ramping up, and as they ramped up, the resolve of the citizens to demand their rights became stronger and stronger. And then that's why we read the Tory Acts at the very beginning of the year, because to be honest, when you actually look in any documents where there is a reference of Thomas Paine, you know, by the framers, I mean, John Adams had most of the framers that were involved in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress, and so forth, most of those men had disdain for Thomas Paine. He was an Englishman. He was not an American citizen. He came over here rebel-rousing, trying to sell his pamphlets so that it would stir up the people to quickly take up arms instead of letting the people cognitively organize themselves and determine what best route to take. I mean, we kind of talk about this all the time, right? If all of a sudden we just start taking up arms, we throw away everything that we've done, because all we're going to have left is what little things we might be able to preserve coming out of the, you know, the deadly force or the projection of deadly force from weapons and so forth. So to preserve a civil society, was the intent of our forefathers, and the design of the Constitution was to give us all of the power necessary to preserve our civil society. So when these gentlemen decided to just start taking up arms, they kind of forgot what they should have started with the petitions. And this right was already galvanized in the Bill of Rights. So as we look, and this was really very specific territory. It wasn't like they had to go to Massachusetts and New Jersey and all of the different colonies. The place that they actually had the problem was Western Pennsylvania. Now, I don't know if all the distilleries were there. I don't think so. I think it was because this was considered a wild territory. It wasn't let, you know, Western Pennsylvania ended up becoming Ohio. And it was a part of the Northwest Ordinance, so it wasn't really under the control of Pennsylvania, though the only government close by, because they didn't do the due diligence in creating the territory or what have you by this point in time, they were reliant upon Pennsylvania. So I understand the point of how, you know, they seem to be repeating, or it came across as an unfair tax. But the bottom line is, and the question, and Washington actually did a consensus. Washington basically went around in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and so forth and said, hey, is this a good thing to do? And everybody said, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea. It was the people that had to pay the tax, the distillers, that had the problem. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I see this as, yeah, it was a very unfavorable tax because, one, it was a tax that was being levied upon a very specific industry, but that industry was pretty prolific throughout the states. In other words, this was deemed as a uniform tax throughout the Union, and therefore there were some areas that said, hey, I don't want to have to pay, you know, all this type of tax. The taxes were seemed unfair. I mean, it's not that there weren't problems, but the bottom line is that for the most part, you know, nobody was willing to go to drastic measures other than out here. This was one of the reasons why George Washington was hesitant to take action, because we're looking in the time frame of 70, 71. This was 73 when things started escalating. Now, let me ask you this. If the government has passed this tax law, they're trying to enforce this, and you're getting away with harassing and not paying taxes, then, and a couple of years have gone by, what are you going to do? Are you going to fold and start paying taxes? No, it's almost like their ineptness is enabling you. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so because they didn't go to the militia faster, I think that it enabled and created a paradigm that they could continue to steep up their rancor and disdain and actions against this tax. Had, I think, Washington deployed the militia quickly with prejudice and said, look, this is the law. You may not like it, but there's a process. You can petition government for the redress of grievances, and you'll probably lose because this is within government's powers. We have the power to do this. You may not like it, but we have the power to do it. So we're going to enforce this, and we mean to enforce this. So this went on, again, and I think that created an enabling of more bad behavior. So keep going, by all means.
I was going to say, I looked up some stuff real quick, and it seems that whiskey was their currency in that area of Western Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, probably so. Probably so.
They
so
had few banks, little access to cash, gold, and silver.
Yeah, so I'll let you repeat all of that because the music kind of, you know, overwhelmed you. So when we come back, I'll let you repeat what you looked up as far as the cash. Because whiskey was back in those days, the currency was the crops, whether it be tobacco, what have you. So We'll be right back after the short promo, and then we'll dive back into this whiskey tax.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, Sean, we went into break right before you started talking about what you found. So let's go ahead, because you're talking about a cash crop or a currency with whiskey. Go ahead.
Yeah, they were on the western side of the Appalachians, and it was really like frontier type land and rural, and they didn't have access to banks or cash, or there was no stable circulation of federal notes, and grain, especially rye and wheat, was converted into whiskey, which was easier to transport. It could be traded directly, and it functioned as a local medium of exchange. So it really hit, I would think that it would hit them pretty hard, since they're basically on a barter system pretty much.
Wait, but it was a highly consumable as well, because
it was
basically wheat broth that could be preserved.
Right,
because bottom line, it's something that would survive without refrigeration, that would give you nutrients. And so America, because of technology and everything else, you know, everybody was, I don't want to say everybody was an alcoholic, but alcohol was integral in the survival of many American families. And back in those days, I mean, they probably allowed their kids to have some of the grain liquor because it was needed nutrients, right? I mean, so they didn't have, you know, the necessary laws that we see today, you know, the blue laws, the Puritan laws, and so forth. So things were a lot different back then, a lot different. And yes, you know, when you actually have this, you know, commodity being traded, it's not just a commodity, it's a consumable.
Yeah.
So it was...
How were they supposed to get the gold or whatever they had to use to pay the tax if they're operating on trading whiskey for food or the alcohol for food or other things that they... That was their currency.
Right.
So they didn't have access to gold or notes. Right. So how were they supposed to pay the tax?
Well, it takes time for this government to develop. We already went through this thing of 1792, the Coinage Act. That's why the next thing we go through is the Whiskey Rebellion. Because they still have yet to establish this gold and silver coinage that we were to deploy as a part of our currency and our economic system. And so, you know, it took a little while. And so the concept, now just to be clear here, when you look at the role that gold and silver is supposed to have, the states are prohibited in creating a law that allows anything other than gold and silver to be the legal tender for the payment of debt. Which means if you walk into a business and you want to do a transaction, that business has to take currency. There are businesses today that are telling you we don't take currency. And bottom line, you can go and you can call the sheriff and say, you're going to take currency, whether you like it or not. And I'm calling the law. I'm going to call a law enforcement officer, and I'm going to get this person here, and I'm going to show that in the Constitution, no state can make or enforce any law that abridges my privileges and immunities as a U.S. citizen. No state can create a law by the restriction placed upon it to allow anything other than gold and silver coin. And right now, the only thing that we have that the unconstitutionally that they've adopted is this unbacked paper currency. Whether you like it or not, this is the current legal tender for the payment of debt. So you have to take it. Don't let folks, you stop anybody in their tracks if they're going to try to inflict unconstitutional policies and rules and regulations because they don't want to deal with it. If they don't want to deal with it, then they need to follow the same process you and I have to follow, and that is to champion an amendment to allow the currency to be taken away and going into a cashless society. They're basically turning their backs, and we have to hold them accountable. Is this making sense, Sean?
Absolutely. So, but I'm going to tell you right now, where I live, there's a whole bunch of stores that won't take cash. And you can call the sheriff all day. He's not coming to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, so
he's coming to run you off.
So that's why we need to just, that's why we have to start doing petitions regarding a digital currency, regarding a cash society, so that you can actually start, you know, petitioning the sheriff and your county legislators to say, look, these institutions, these businesses that are not taking cash, this is unconstitutional. We need people to actually, this is where we need to get the youth, because that's the people that are willing to go sleep on a jail floor to do, you know, these types of what you call civil unrest, unfortunately. But we have to start petitioning first. We have to start the petitioning, and if government chooses to turn their back on their duty, then we need to actually start waking people up that we got to replace these people, because going to a cashless society should be completely unacceptable. We have to start educating people that your cash is your property. You, in other words, when you look at everything you own, Sean, you, and if we could get anybody just to imagine all of the property, all of your physical holdings, from the lamps and your furniture to, you know, your car, anything that you claim to be yours and that you have exclusive right to, should be able to be transmuted or transformed into a currency. In other words, when a person dies, their property is transformed into currency to liquidate that estate so that all the members of the estate can be paid equally their fair share. That's the whole point of currency, is to basically allow you to build an estate with currency and then transform your estate back into currency to liquidate it for your heirs or those who were, you know, and so in some ways you can will property and those types of things, but in the simplest of terms, the liquidation of an estate is transforming that into a physical currency to where it can be evenly divided, where it is not government involved or bank involved. It is literally the family involved in executing the liquidation and the severing of the property and the distribution of the estate. Does that make sense? Because bringing government into this and bringing into this cashless society, we cannot do it ourselves anymore, which means it is not our property anymore. Any comment?
I was saying that that's a big rabbit hole opening, and that the banks are part of the problem where we are now.
Oh, absolutely. There. So, but you know what? We're not a government. We're not a bank form of government. We're a Republican form of government, which means we the people, which means we and our the people's government have all the control and all the say. And so we need to silence these people who have actually chosen the direction for us, and they're quietly implementing plans and trying to make everything seem convenient. The day they close the door on your property is the day you realize you are now a serf.
Correct.
You're no longer an individual sovereign. So, folks, this is the huge transition, and you will rue the day when this happens if we don't start petitioning. So this is why we already have Petition 7 out there. All you need to do is work with us. We will create that transition of a local petition in using Petition 7. Because Petition 7 basically states that no state can allow anything other than gold and silver coin, or unfortunately, whatever the unconstitutional currency we have today, we cannot allow it to continually slip into a cashless society. We have to demand that at a minimum currency be used, and we have to also demand that our local government start pushing back in restoring our gold and silver currency. Because that's what the Constitution has not been amended to take that away from us. And everybody that's looking at how they're being affected by inflation, going back to the gold and silver currency will wipe out inflation. Because you can't just print gold. You can't just print silver. You've got the silver. That is your currency. You want to inflate it. You got to go get more gold and put it into circulation. This is why when you really look at whatever it is, the product of man as a cash crop or as a currency, well, shoot, you can easily inflate or deflate the value by just making more and more and more of it to a point where the value of whiskey becomes nothing because everybody's making it. It's just like tomatoes. You know, you could have, you know, saffron right now is one of the most expensive herbs, period, because it's just hard to get. And it's, you know, you can make it yourself. It's just cactus, right? It's a flower of a cactus. You can grow the cactus in your home. You can start harvesting it. But until you do, you have to pay a high price on saffron, you know, organic saffron. Well, why isn't it that people are actually starting to grow? Because, you know, cactus is very easy to propagate, right? It's a succulent. And so my point is that, you know, we kind of ignore these markets, you know, these commodities and so forth. But we live under a constitutional framework that basically says our economy, our currency, must be gold and silver based, period. So anyway, I'll let you get back to this again. I know this is a huge rat hole, but nevertheless, go ahead.
All right. Feeling up unrepresented in Congress, the citizens of Western Pennsylvania gathered their own assembly with 3 to 5 representatives per county. While radical members pushed for open rebellion, moderates like Hugh Henry Breckinridge and future Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Albert Gallatin urged conciliatory measures. In the summer of 1794, Federal Marshal David Lennox began the process of serving writs to 60 distillers in western Pennsylvania who had not paid the tax. On July 14th, Lennox accepted the services of tax collector and wealthy landowner John Neville as guide through Allegheny County.
Okay, keep going.
Go ahead. The attack on John Neville's home, Bower Hill. On July 15th, they approached the home of William Meyer, who refused to accept his summons. An argument ensued, and when Lennox and Neville rode off, they were face to face with an angry mob armed with pitchforks and muskets. Someone had told the mob that federal agents were dragging people away, but Lennox and Neville were allowed to pass once that was understood to be untrue. Nonetheless, a shot was fired as the two men rode away. It sounded eerily familiar to something that's going on now, huh?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. So this is why going through these things, because this is, got to remember that the Constitution, the ink had just dried. The men that were making the decisions went through the process of, you know, how to deal with these things. This was the first time they actually had to execute some parts of the Constitution, like calling forth a militia and so forth. And we'll get into that after we go through all of this. But keep going.
Someone had told the mob, I already read that part. On the morning of July 16th, Neville was asleep in his home, Bower Hill, when he was awakened by a crowd of angry men, some of whom had been served summons the previous day. The men claimed that Lennox needed to come with them because there was a threat to his life. Neville didn't believe the men and ordered them off his property. When the mob refused to move, Neville grabbed a gun and shot at the crowd, striking and killing Oliver Miller.
Okay.
In retaliation, the mob shot back at the house.
Okay, so because the first life that was lost wasn't done by the mob, it was done by somebody in protecting themselves in doing their duty, this was not viewed as, you know, like what we see today in the protests where the mobs are coming with bricks, guns, and so forth, and actually invoking and instigating and starting needless violence, damage, and harm. You understand the difference here?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I just wanted, because everybody, the mobbers here, it's not like, you know, they didn't like what was going on. They reached a level of frustration. And instead of dealing with this directly with their government, they dealt with it with the tax man. In other words, we're holding you accountable because we don't like you. Technically, had they followed the constitutional process, that they somehow, for some reason, had forgotten. And in all honesty, that should be a part of the civics process. Kids need to learn that the first thing you do is you petition government for the redress of grievances. Something's happening, you're not happy? Then you create a petition, and you get in front of your government, and you petition them. Keep going. So Neville made it inside
the house and sounded a signal horn, after which he heard the sound of his slaves attacking the crowd with firearms. Six members of the mob were wounded before they fled with Miller's body. By evening, the mob had reconvened for a meeting with a group of other people who declared revenge on Neville.
Okay, so another thing.
He had slaves in Pennsylvania?
There you go. There you go. And so, but if you look at the relationship, his slaves had arms. So, in other words, I don't think these were slaves. I believe that these were serfs. I believe that these were people that had a level of independence to where they had access to arms, and they had this trust and this relationship that they were, you know, they weren't property. They were, you know, they were taken care of. They're kind of like, you know, the best way to refer to this is they were more of serfs than slaves. In other words, they were kind of attached to the land, and that, you know, they grew up and they raised and worked the land, and that was their focus as a serf.
Or maybe they were worried about what was going to happen to them if their master got killed.
Absolutely, but the point is that they still had direct access to firearms. In other words, in the South, the slaves do not have any access to firearms.
Right.
Right. Okay. Because in other words, the relationship was...
You never know.
The relationship was definitely different. So go ahead, the destruction of Bower Hill.
So he was a good master.
Okay. But they had a more of a symbiotic relationship, if that makes sense. Okay.
Okay. The destruction of Bower Hill. On July 17, 1794, as many as 700 men marched to drums and gathered at Neville's home. They demanded his surrender, but Major James Kirkpatrick, one of 10 soldiers who had come to the property to help defend it, answered that Neville was not there. In fact, Kirkpatrick had helped Neville escape the house and hide in a ravine. The mob demanded that the soldiers surrender. When that request was refused, they set fire to a barn and slave dwellings. The Neville women were allowed to flee to safety, after which the mob opened fire on the house. Following an hour of gunfighting, the mob's leader, James McFarlane, was killed. In a rage, the mob set fire to the other buildings, and the soldiers soon surrendered as the Bower Hill estate burned to the ground.
Okay, so obviously, because somebody got killed, they came back to basically, what, extract vengeance, right? Instead of going to court, instead of, you know, allowing, you know, a corrupt court to get involved, They wanted to extract vengeance. Now, technically, in common law and all those sorts of things, they didn't have corrupt courts back then, but that's what we got today. But the criticality is they came back with a large mob of, what, 700 people. And they set out to destroy every dwelling on that property because this, you know, Neville had killed a mob leader. That's what they called him. But he was a leader of the group that was standing up to tyranny. Okay, so things escalated from this point. So because again, because a person was killed, but that person that was killed was basically a person in the insurrection side, and government enforcer did the killing. There wasn't a trial for Neville to basically stand trial for murder. Does that make sense?
Well, it made sense that he wasn't held liable for defending his property.
And doing his job that his government had basically hired him to do. Okay, so let's do a threat to Pittsburgh, and this is where we kind of see things taking a turn. Go ahead.
A threat to Pittsburgh. Less than a week later, the mob met with local dignitaries who warned that Washington would send a militia to strike them down, and they had to strike first. Wealthy landowner David Bradford, along with several other men, attacked the mail carrier and discovered three letters from Pittsburgh expressing disapproval of the attack on Neville's property. Bradford used these letters as an excuse to encourage an attack on Pittsburgh, inciting 7,000 men to show up at Braddock's Field east of the city. The city of Pittsburgh, fearing violence, sent a delegation to announce that the three letter writers had been expelled from the city and to offer a gift of several barrels of whiskey.
Okay, so hold on. So hold on here, right there. So what's interesting is that the people in the rural area, they knew to quickly organize. They knew that, you know, they, in other words, this was kind of the militia, the local militia, banding together to support their plight. But what did the people of Pittsburgh do? Because they had 7,000 men from the countryside get together to basically march into Pittsburgh. And so what happened was, as you just read, they sent a delegation. They didn't have an army of 7,000. Right. They sent just a delegation saying, hey, hold on here. You know, and before you get all upset, have some whiskey. And that takes the steam out. You know, when it comes to men, I mean, by this point in time, they've already done manly things. They're, you know, we've gotten here. Yeah, let's have a whiskey. Let's raise our glass and, you know, and enjoy. Right? So keep going.
As the day ended, the crowd had drunk deeply from the barrels and weren't inspired to descend on Pittsburgh with any fury. Instead, gaining permission to march through Pittsburgh peacefully.
Okay, so
they decided to have a parade instead because they were all drunk.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's what happens, right? So if you studied history, you would know that how many times had, you know, angry forces been quelled because you gave them a bunch of booze. Oh, well, yeah, okay, well, and then all of a sudden they become, you know, pliable and, you know, amenable to, oh, okay, you gave us a good buzz, so we're just gonna pass by without really burning you down. Yeah, okay, all right, thank you so much for the buzz. Yeah, that's what it was. It was a transaction to say, you guys get drunk on us and just leave us alone, okay? Okay, so now...
It seems so ironic that they gave them whiskey and that's what they were about to...
Yeah. Correct. You know, they could have used that as cash.
Right, they could have paid their taxes.
There you go. But they didn't want to pay taxes. They weren't going to pay taxes with it. So... Now, Washington sends the militia. So the way the story, you know, was captured, they didn't talk. This story doesn't talk about what was really happening in the background. And what happened in the background, I believe it was either 1792 or it may have been a little bit earlier, the Congress passed an Insurrection Act. And we're talking about the Insurrection Act today. As a matter of fact, it's playing prevalence in, you know, in social media and on the news and everything else, because, you know, they're using the Insurrection Act to go after these Democrats who have basically told military people to not follow their orders and so forth. So this is why I want to cover this story, and then we're going to dive into the Insurrection Act, and we're going to dive into kind of the flow of how Congress responded to the Whiskey Rebellion, because that's what's really happening. It wasn't like Washington gathered the militia on his own. He had no power to do it. He needed Congress to call forth the militia. So let's go into this part right here, because I kind of cover everything as an aside that we'll see, but what we'll try to do, because we only got a minute, so just go ahead and read these last couple paragraphs.
Washington sends the militia with signs that the rebels were hoping to reignite the conflict and believing it was linked to unrest in other parts of the country. Hamilton wanted to send troops to Pennsylvania, but Washington opted for a peace envoy instead. The peace envoy failed. Washington met with his cabinet officials and presented evidence of the violence to Supreme Court Justice James Wilson, who ruled the military response was justified under the auspices of the Militia Acts of 1792. Washington assumed emergency power to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states in eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia.
Okay. All right. So we've got 1 minute to kind of cover this. So James Wilson...
Why did he ask the Supreme Court justice permission? I don't understand that part.
So Washington was afraid of being a heavy-handed military man anymore. He was the president. Right. And so why did he not just sign the whiskey excise tax instead of going up to Pennsylvania and around, you know, Virginia and so forth and getting a consensus? We see how many presidents actually gained. Bill Clinton was the president of consensus. He would go around and he'd make sure that there was enough people to support what he wanted to do, and then he would push forward. Or he would sell people on it and obtain the consensus. So that's what politicians do, and Washington truly was a politician. And I think most people kind of miss that.
I understand where he's coming from, because they just come out the war and the country was just getting on its feet. So I could understand why he wanted to give the impression to the people that he was being a statesman and letting the government function. I just didn't understand why it was the Supreme Court and not Congress.
Okay, and perfect timing, because we just ended on what Sean had wanted to contribute and we got it out. Excellent. Thank you, Sean, for joining us. And so we can continue this, and we will continue this in our next episode. But we will probably be bringing you Jerry Wistrand and his plight in fighting the party in Missouri and why he needs your support. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.